first pack was the A4 file, and then got to the sixth factor, which was restraints. And then we come to the seventh factor, which is the mindfulness. And I will start again with the introduction, the basic lesson from the four focuses of mindfulness. The four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only: the purification of beings, the going beyond sadness and crying to spheres of physical and mental suffering, the attainment of the true way for realization of nirvana. What are the four? Pause. You may have noticed that some translators, and really they have no authority from the Pali to say this, so it is the only way. The word is ekayana. It's not ekayana. You may think that's just being picky, but those are two different words. Eka one, yana, like Mahayana or Hinayana, path, vehicle. Yes, yana means that, but it's not ekayana, it's ekayana. And that means a one going, a path leading in one direction only. It's not the only path. The only path is reserved for the Eightfold Path. That is again and again and again said by the Buddha to be the only path for to attain Nirvana. Eso wa marga nati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. That's verse 372 of the Dhammapada. And I said that in Pali and I quoted it just to impress you. I know what I'm talking about. Because I mean, that's if anyone was going to construct in Pali, this is the only path. That would be the way they'd say it. Eso wa magga. This the only path. Nati anya. There is no other for the purity of insight. And that refers to the Eightfold Path. But anyway, the mindfulness is important. It's not as if all you need to do is mindfulness and nothing else, and that will somehow lead you to Nirvana. If that was the case, the Buddha would have taught a sevenfold path or onefold path. So the Buddha was very nice, very kind, keep it simple. So you need all of these eight factors of the path. And so first of all, it leads in one direction only. And the other justification for that, two suttas after the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, there we have the word used again, ekayana, a path. And the Buddha was talking about how he can predict the karmic consequences of people or acts. That it's like going into a forest. It's a path which has no left turn, no right turn, no U-turns allowed. It's going in one direction, it has to lead there. There's no way that it can not lead there. And that gives you a pictorial image of what this ekayana means. But what is that path of the four focuses of mindfulness? And you may have noticed I call it four focuses of mindfulness rather than the four foundations of mindfulness, because it is where the mindfulness is directed. The place is where you'll find the liberation, and in particular, because if those places are focused on things like the body, it's amazing how people still believe the body is, you know, it's their permanent essence. Experience, the second factor of the four Satipatthanas, and instead of calling it feeling or emotions, call it actually what it really should be called, experience. Because your experience comes in three flavors, but we're talking about the experience, not the flavors of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And even the word Veda and the Vedati, it means you just experience things. So again, slightly different nuances in the translations have a lot of influence on how you practice these things. Aware of experience, aware of the mind, the citta, and aware of these three. For the main thing of the false Satipatthana is the two parts, the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. So you're aware of those because those are what obstruct you from becoming enlightened, or which propel you, which you should develop to become enlightened. And we'll go to that in a few moments. But all of these, having restrained the five hindrances, always comes first. Vinaye loke abhijato manasang. Restrain the five hindrances. You haven't abandoned them, but you've really weakened them. You abide aware of the body, aware of experience, aware of the mind, aware of the mind objects. Energize, knowing the purpose of what you're doing, and mindful. So, mindfulness of the body, first of all. And the first part of mindfulness of the body is the mindfulness of breathing. Anapanasati. You go to a quiet, secluded place, such as Kairos Center. You sit down comfortably. You turn off your mobile phones, even in this area, please. If you want to use your mobile phones, message sometimes, some people, please do it in your rooms. And give priority to establishing mindfulness. This is a word called Parimukkham, which sometimes say in front of you. Establish mindfulness in front of you. Some people translate that up. In front of who? There's no one supposed to be here. And anyway, where do I live? In front of my nose? Is that where I am? In front of my nose? So in front of me, I'm behind my nose, and I establish mindfulness here. But it never means that. Parimukkham is very similar to the English word priority. Putting it first. Putting ahead of everything else. Putting it in front. So, number one of the things to do is establish mindfulness. That is one of the reasons why when I teach meditation, I teach a lot about getting your body nice and comfortable. And in so doing, you are establishing mindfulness of your body as you go through it, being aware, relaxing it, feeling the right of a relaxed body. It is a way of developing mindfulness on something which is really important, because you know you're going to be sitting for half an hour, whatever. Sometimes when you teach meditation to people with cancer, of course it's much easier for them in the sense that this is important, this is life and death. So they don't mess around, they establish mindfulness, feel their body first of all. But at the end of that body meditation, at least, you're not wandering around all over the place. You're not planning, thinking, fantasizing. You are aware. You're establishing mindfulness as the first priority. And then you get into the inner world, present moment awareness. You're not really mindful if you're thinking of the future, because you're not aware of what's happening right now. As you're thinking of what you're going to do tomorrow, you're not really aware of what's happening now if you're always thinking about the past. You're like those absent-minded professors who are just about to do a breakthrough in quantum physics, and they keep stepping in the dog poo on the path because they're washing their head and they're not really in real life. Ajahn Chah would always tell the Western monks that we had stupid feet. Stupid feet. I thought feet didn't have a brain or anything, but what he meant was because we walk many places without any shoes on, and we keep on treading on rocks or little stubs of trees, and we keep on cutting our feet. Our feet were usually covered with band-aids in those early years, and because as we were walking through the forest, we were thinking on the meaning of nirvana and cessation, rather looking at our feet where we were going. We were in our head, not in our feet. It's the feet which suffered as a result. So, you have mindfulness in this moment. What's important is what's right in front of you. And then, the silence. Because I mentioned that already, the first talk, seeing the sunset, oh, what a beautiful sunset that is. As soon as you say something, you're not watching the sunset, you're watching the description, the commentary of it. But that feeling it before the thoughts distort the experience and describe it as you think it is rather than as it actually is, the silence is far closer to the truth. So once you are in this present moment and silent, you're pretty close to being really mindful. Then, once you have established mindfulness as a priority, then mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. And I have to thank that my first, the first abbot of Bodhinyana Maharishi in Perth, that was Ajahn Chakra, still a very good friend, and he, of course he's a good friend, but he just wrote, but I remember him telling me, give me some really good advice, saying, Ajahn Brahm, you're a really inspiring teacher when you teach meditation about the nimittas and the jhanas, but most people are more interested in how just to get mindful of the breath for a few minutes. So can you please balance your teaching and focus it more on the early stages of meditation? And that was wonderful, kind advice from him. And so I spent a long time, how you just be able to become aware of a few breaths, one after the other, without falling asleep, without going into fantasy land, that you can actually watch the breath, maybe 10 or 20 breaths easy. And I'll go count and I say 10 or 20, think, okay, 10 or 20. Master said I have to watch 10 or 20. But it is, you know, so there's no distractions, so you can really settle on your breathing. So, once you can watch the breath with reasonable ease, then we do the breath meditation, that's where it starts. So you don't start as soon as you sit down. Sit down, cross your legs, okay, watch your breath. In, out, in, out. I wonder what I'm having for dinner tonight. Actually, we're not having dinner tonight. Maybe I can sneak out and get something at the Subway, as I've talked about. So straight away, you've lost your breath. So because it's not your fault, don't go into blame and you realise there's no one there, it's all conditioning. So instead of going into blame, we just realise that, you know, we haven't really done the preparation. One of the big problems for our Western Buddhists, we rush. And we just can't do this ordinary stuff. I want to get my nimittas. Quick! So just take your time, so you can actually be mindful, be aware, and then you can be watch the breath with pretty much ease. Just comes in, comes out, it's always there. So you understand how to be with your breath. And one of the things that's not said here, but it was from earlier, when they write your motivations, you're kind, you're gentle, you're letting go of other things. Let go of everything else and just allow the breath to stay with you for a while. That's a really good friend. So when the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware they are short. You learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. Then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. The first four steps. Now, you may have noticed that that's slightly different from the usual way the breath meditation is presented, in that it is not so much repetition. Because the original says, when breathing in a short in-breath, you are aware that you are breathing in a short in-breath. When breathing out a short out-breath, you are aware that you are breathing out a short out-breath. When you're breathing in a long in-breath, you're aware you're breathing in a long in-breath. too much repetition when all you need is, when you translate sentences, you understand its meaning, how would you say that to a friend? Don't keep the word-for-word translations. Instead, I know what it means, very simple. How would you say that in German, in Sinhala, or whatever, so you really understand what the meaning is? Now you don't experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. You learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. Now, first of all, I've been in a long breath and a short breath. What actually is the qualification to be a short breath? How short does it have to be? What about a long breath? Do you have to really try hard to be a short breath? Or really try hard to manage a long breath? Is that long enough, teacher? And it confused me because sometimes my breath was not long, was not short, was sort of in the middle somewhere. But what is the purpose of that? All it means is it gives you something of interest to add to the breath. How long is it? How short is it? You don't have to do one and then the other. You just know your breath, natural breath, sitting here, is it sort of longish or shortish or somewhere in the middle? Just gives you something extra on which your awareness can hang on to your breath. And those two first two stages of Anapanasati, of mindfulness of the breath, doesn't mean you have to do first complete number one, then complete number two. It means either or in between, or any sort of skillful means, like counting with the breath. Breathing in one, breathing out one, or whatever, or having these mantras you stay with the breath. Like in Thailand, they used to do Buddho, Buddho along with the breath. When I went to Australia, that didn't really sort of cut it with the Australians. That didn't have a meaning for them. So instead of using Buddha with the in-breath, Tho with the out-breath, I just experimented. The one thing which I did next was, as you breathe in, say to yourself, shut. As you breathe out, up. Up. And that's the response. People started laughing rather than becoming still. So I tried something else. And because many people were sick, I thought, why not say breathing in sort of health or energy or peace? And breathe out, let go. So that became the one which I've used most of the time. Breathing in peace. Breathe out, let go. But not just words. Just make a sort of picture, a vision about what peace means to you. Feel it. It's just a word. Breathe in peace. Breathe out, let go. Peace, let go. Peace, let go. Peace, let go. Peace, let go. Because the words have to have a resonance, an emotional resonance for you. What is peace for you? How do you visualize it? How do you feel it? So you imagine that coming in with every in-breath. And let go. What are you trying to let go of? If a person has got some sort of tumor, great. Imagine the tumor sort of partially just disappearing with the out-breath, going out there into the world, disappearing from breathing in peace, breathing out tumor. Those sort of things work. Breathing in peace, breathing out anxiety. Breathing in peace, breathing out tiredness. Those are things which work, because they have to really catch you and really understand what those words mean. It's important for you. And then it works. It makes the breath really interesting. But that's only just to get aware of the breath. Afterwards, you start to and to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. You got the breath, just like I use my finger here. As my finger goes from left to right, that's just the long breath or short breath. No, I just see it passing. But for the whole of the breath, if I just start to see the breath at the extreme of its leftness, which happens naturally as you really start getting into breath meditation, your awareness brightens up and you can obviously see more of it. And you learn to experience the whole of the breath, then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. You don't calm the breath as well, you learn how it works. Because you're not doing very much, because you don't need so much oxygen, it means the breath gets very slow and calm and smooth naturally. You just calm, patience, and the breath starts to slow down. In the same way, when you have a car and you park your car, you haven't turned the engine off yet, obviously the amount of fuel which your car consumes gets less and less and less and less. It's stationary. And the simile, just as a skilled painter is aware whether they're making a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke, so too when the in-breath is gone, you're aware that it's gone. And of course that is changing the simile but keeping the meaning. The original simile you may have heard was just as a lathe turner knows when he's doing a long cut or a short cut. Now that is where you had the old lathe, and I remember building one of those lathes in Thailand 45 years ago, so that simile in its original means something to me. But these days lathes are electric, spinning around, and you don't really get the meaning of that simile. But when you change it in to another simile like brush strokes, you know, if you're doing a short brush stroke or a long brush stroke, that gives a much better simile meaning of what the Buddha meant. And in this way you're aware of your own body, other people's body, the same nature of yours, you're quite aware of the nature of both your own and others' body. Now, in particular, just bodies, that's all, nothing special. And later on I will talk about the arising and passing away of a body, which doesn't just mean it coming and going, it means why it comes, why it goes. See if I can get this. Where we have the four nutriments. But anyway, now there are many other parts of the body awareness, but I am now going to go much further and go into the Anapanasati Sutta, because this is where the Buddha also describes the four Satipatthanas as a way, as described through how breath meditation works. This is actually what is the the Anapanasati Sutta. So it is the quote: when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness. It completes the four focuses of mindfulness when you do Anapanasati. So if you want to do the four focuses of mindfulness, do Anapanasati. It completes it, fulfills it. Basically, it means doing Anapanasati is equivalent to the four focuses of mindfulness. There is no difference. Satipatthana, Anapanasati are the same. So said the Buddha, the final expert. And when the four focuses of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they complete the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they complete true knowledge and deliverance, awakening. Now here we go. Mindfulness of breathing completes the four focuses of mindfulness. And how does mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated complete the four focuses of mindfulness? The reason I'm focusing on this is because it gives you some really interesting information on how your meditation develops and works. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you are aware they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you are aware they are short. When you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out, on each occasion you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the person, mindful. Because in and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body, in the category bodies. That is why in that occasion a meditator abides mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. And I don't know how many of you have been to many different teachers, but the third of those steps in Anapanasati, being aware of the whole breath. Some teachers say it means being aware of the whole body. And just, I cannot see the logic behind that. Even the Buddha said the breath is a body, part of the body. And so it's not that you know a long breath and a short breath, and then you suddenly be aware of the whole of your body, including your toes and your ears and every other part. It means the whole body of the breath. Anyone who gets into these teachings deeply will get to know that the word kaya does not just mean your physical body. It is used for many other things. And those of you who follow international Buddhism know even things like Dharmakaya. It doesn't mean, or it, you know, it's almost something which is used by Mahayana teachings as well. You have Namakaya. It just means a group of things. In the same way, a body of evidence does not mean all the dead bodies somebody has murdered. A body of evidence means this, you know, the accumulated facts of a case. You have the Dhamma kind, the body of Dhamma. And what it means is not what a physical body, it means a collection of things. In Pali and in English, there's a lot of similarities. Anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath, of prana. What is the first precept of the five precepts? Prana Atipata Viramani. Prana also means breathing beings. What most is living beings. And what is the word for a being in English? Animals. What is the word for breath in Latin? Animalis. These languages are very similar. That's why it's really not that hard to actually to learn a bit of Pali. A lot of the teachings, a lot of the controversies become very clear to you. So, we have here, we are aware of the breath. Now, what happens next? These are like the juicy parts of meditation, which I'd like to focus on and encourage, because too many other people just don't do this. They don't point this out, and it stops people's development of meditation. The fifth step of Anapanasati is also the second part of Satipatthana. Satipatthana, second part, it's not looking at the body anymore, it's looking at Vedana, the experience. Especially pleasant, unpleasant. There's another part of the breath you are focusing on. When you learn to experience joy, pity, as you breathe in and out. And sometimes people experience pity, they get so much joy and happiness, you cry. Cry with joy. I've done that many times. And so if you start crying through meditation, go for it. And don't, if anyone is crying like that during the meditation, don't just go and put your arms around them and give them a hug, oh you poor thing. Look, they're having a great time, don't stop them. So the crying is not out of sadness, out of joy. Oh yeah. So you learn to experience joy, pity as you breathe in and out. When you learn to experience pleasure, sukha, as you breathe in and out. When you learn to experience the mental formation, the citta sankhara of pity sukha, as you breathe in and out. When you learn to calm this mental formation of pity sukha as you breathe in and out. All experiencing joy and happiness. This is what I call the delightful breath. Breathing in. Breathing out, whoa, this is good stuff. You don't say that, but that's how you feel. And what happens is this breath becomes really fun to do. Meditation becomes something you look forward to. Wow! Why hasn't anyone told me about this before? I can sit down and really enjoy myself. And that is what happens when you meditate. Unfortunately, some people say if you're enjoying it, you must be doing it wrong. You've got to suffer. This is suffering. Wipe that smile off your face. Unfortunately, that's when I first went, obviously being born in Acton, first went to a church, an Anglican church. The pews were old oak, they were so solid and they really hurt your bottom. And it was so cold, everything was stone, it was like hot, it was like being in a prison. And even the preacher, such boring sermons, never really related to you. And they never, what I learned giving talks, you don't just say, oh, monoto, the Buddha taught four noble truths, the first noble truth is suffering. Not telling people what they already know, I'm putting some energy, some oomph into your presentation, changing the tone of your voice to engage people. And there's Sora, which is so cold and so miserable. And when you came across meditation on the heart of Buddhist practices and know how joyful it is, wow, I want some of that. That's what I thought. So anyway, where does this joy come from? You learn to experience the pity, the sukha, the pity sukha, and to calm the pity sukha as you breathe in and out. Because this, they say, is a calmest mental formation, citta sankhara. It's what the mind adds to the breathing. The power of mindfulness. If the breath is just the breath. But when your mind really wakes up and gets some power, some positive energy, wow, everything looks really gorgeous and beautiful. Everything. You know what's coming next, don't you, Ben? My gross simile. And the reason I say this is just, number one, it was real, it happened. And number two, it's just, how you can look at something like the breath and just so joyful, so wonderful, so gorgeous. And that was at the retreat I was giving in Australia. And just like everybody else, I like to take the opportunities to meditate with you or meditate in my room. I love my meditation. And so, okay, I'm attached to it. I don't mind saying that. It's much better than being attached to other things. Anyway, so I'll say what happens when you're attached to meditation later on. I should might as well say it now. It's the Buddha said in the in the Pasarika Sutta. Yeah. And there he said that anyone who gets attached to the pleasures of meditation can only expect four consequences. This is what happens if you get attached to joy in meditation. Be warned. you will either become a stream winner, a once returner, a non returner, or fully enlightened. The four consequences. It's not bad, is it? I'll sign up for that. Brilliant teaching of the Buddha. Sometimes as if he almost knew sort of how people would try and think that, oh no, you've got to suffer to get enlightened. And he was saying, if you enjoy those pleasures, just the meditations, you're on the path, you're going to get somewhere. Anyway, so the story is, I went to the toilet. Ah, to go to the toilet, just because, you know, you get deep meditation doesn't mean you have to evacuate your system every now and again. So there I was, doing a number two. And after doing the number two, I looked into the toilet bowl.
Wow.
Never in my life, I'll get into this because it's funny, but it's accurate. I never ever in my life seen such a beautiful piece of feces just floating there in the bowl. Now look, check this out next time that you do a number two. It's not just one shade of brown. It's darker browns, lighter browns. And just, if anyone is trained in art school, it's the interaction of the different colours which creates the sense of beauty. It was like this had been painted, you know, by someone who really knew just now how the interaction of colours creates a sense of beauty. And then, of course, there was a shape, a number of balls all stuck together, and it was like it was done by Michelangelo. You can actually see just how shapes and forms interact. And then we come to the aroma. Now we have all these other stupid aromas like lavender and rose and jasmine, and they're just, this is earthy. This is like real, not so fake. This is just life in itself. Just, you know, fertilizer. And you could really get into that. The aroma was just not fake at all. And so I was there looking at this most beautiful thing which has ever come out of my backside. I really was sort of getting into it. I was like, wow, that's amazing. And I kept on looking at it and sniffing it. But I thought for a moment, why not take it out and show my friends? Don't you want to share your happy moments with the people you care for? It's a natural instinct. Well, I did do that. The only alternative was to actually flush it away, but that was really hard. It was only because all those years of meditation, all those years of renunciation, you can let it go. It'll come. You put your finger on the button, no, I can't do that. Come on, you can do it. Oh, no, what happened? All right, put it on, please. And I press the button, and the most beautiful piece of shit I'd ever seen went out of my life. I still grieve over it. That's the other thing, in the afternoon when it's hot, always tell funny stories. Everything else which I've taught this afternoon, that's the one you remember. But it's not just for the funny stories, there's something really profound in that. If you can see beauty and delight in what is usually very offensive, imagine what you can do with your enemy, with your ex, with your boss from hell, with Boris Johnson. Mm-hmm. I should keep saying this, I don't know. If you can start seeing beauty in that,
then you learn how you can create compassion anyway, your weaknessness. But more importantly, in meditation, this breath, which is pretty neutral, the citta sankhara, the way you look at it, becomes so gorgeous. See the breath coming in, the breath going out. And of course, you don't need any effort to watch the breath. You're having a beautiful time. And that means your mind is starting to charge up. Power mindfulness. The hindrances are being really weakened now. You don't want anything because what you have is just too enjoyable. You don't want anything else, no aversion, because your mind is content. It's satisfied. It's not at all cool. You're really energized now. Restlessness, you can't take your eyes off it. And doubt, you understand that this is going on the path to freedom. The breath becomes delightful. Those are the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th steps of Anapanasati. Fulfills the second part of the Satipatthana. You're getting insight into the nature of beauty. Beauty is not in the eyes of the beholder. It's not in the thing that you're watching. It's how the mind looks at things. The more powerful your mind is, the more beauty you see in the world. So, the Satipatthana, Anapanasati Satipatthana Sutta, on those occasions you are mindful of experience, having restrained the 5 hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose of the mindful, for being mindful of the pleasure associated with this state of breath meditation is being mindful of experience. Wait a minute. That is why on that occasion a meditator requires mindful of experience, having restrained the 5 hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose of the mindful. And third Satipatthana.
Third Satipatthana. When you learn to experience the citta, this is the 9th step of Anapanasati, experiencing the mind. The citta, I mentioned earlier today, the emperor or empress or the boss, the one in charge of you. The 5 senses have started to disappear now. The breath became the stepping stone. The breath becomes so delightful, the joy becomes so great, that the breath becomes almost drenched and submerged in the joy. So as the joy becomes what you are aware of. When you learn to experience the jitter as you breathe in and out, when you learn to brighten the jitter as you breathe in and out, the joy to the jitter, when you learn to settle the citta as you breathe in and out, when you learn to enter jhana, liberate the citta as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of the citta. Having restrained the 5 hindrances, energized, pretty aware of the purpose and mindful. How do you experience the citta at this stage? That citta you experience really a lot of joy and happiness. That becomes the focus of your awareness. Happens naturally, you can't avoid it. And very often you experience that as a beautiful light in the mind. That is the most common, it's called nimitta. That's how the Buddha described it, nimitta. And those nimittas can be all sorts of shapes and sizes, complicated ones, firework nimittas, what else are the nimittas? Ping pong nimittas, all sorts of nimittas. Even weird nimittas. And now, one of the nimittas which I got a couple of years ago, weird but worth mentioning. In my cave, I knew it was a nimitta because everything, watch the breath really settling down, getting really delightful, the breath starting to vanish, this beautiful image came up in my mind, lots of joy, lots of bliss. It never lasted very long, but I recognized what it was.
I knew it was a nimitta because it was a yellow color. A classic. What a beautiful speech that was. When the mind is really empowered, even screechy sounds are really gorgeous. Can we do that again?
Okay.
Can you hear in the back? Okay. Okay. So I knew it was a nimitta because one of the features of a nimitta is when they come up, obviously lots of joy, lots of happiness, really bristling out, and five senses are disappearing, going further and further away. And one of the other classic signs, whatever color you see is more intense than you can see in real life. If it's a blue, it's a blue like you can never see in this real world. It's more blue than blue. This one was a yellow, a deeper yellow, clear, intense, not fluorescent, but on my pure, intense yellow. Never seen a yellow like that. Can't paint yellows like that. Nothing in the world was like that because it's a pure mental image. But I realized the shape of that yellow nimitta. It was a shape which I could recall. I could see it very clearly. It wasn't a Buddha. It wasn't sort of a deva. It was of Garfield the cat. I've been reading too many cartoons. I'm the only muck ever known who's got the Garfield in the time. I burst out laughing when I was doing that meditation. So do I make big mistakes sometimes. But little nimittas, they're very pure. And after a while, when you first get nimittas, sometimes they are not so pure. They are like a cloth, which is sometimes dirty and stained. What that means is your mind is not that pure. You know, you've been messing around before, after the nimittas, or before the meditation. That was why my mind was pure, but you know, looking at funny Garfield cartoons in the newspapers, that afterwards, you know, you just, that was in your head. And so that was the impurity. The nimitta turned out to be a figure of Garfield. But anyway, that if you see these nimittas and they're a little bit faulty, it means there's some mistake in the purity of your mind, in your precepts, in your kindness. You've been a bit, you haven't said nice words to people. Those things almost have an effect on your mind. They call them defilements, and actually they look like defilements, like stains and smudges on your mind. That's how the mind sees something. So this is where, it's the first time you realize why virtue, precepts, simplicity, generosity, kindness, looking after one another, that selflessness, that is important at this stage of the meditation. If you're really kind, generous, selfless, you never say a bad word to anybody, that type of mind, you see the advantage and result of that when your nimittas are so pure. But, as I said earlier, I know the impulse. If you see an nimitta and it's a bit dirty and smudgy and like a dirty oily rag, don't worry, I can get you through this. What you do, you look for the most beautiful part, the cleanest part of that dirty rag. It's never always all dirty, there's some part which is always more clean than the rest. And you zoom in on that. Zoom in on that. And so the dirty parts fall off the edge. And then you zoom in on the most beautiful part of that most beautiful part you've seen. You keep zooming in on the beautiful parts until you zoom, 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 zoom in. And all you've got is the beautiful part, the pure part. And then you've got this very pure light. You have to have a positive mind that way to do that. People usually have a negative mind. We always focus on the
dirty parts. We always focus on the two bad Greeks in the war. We always focus on the dishes in your kitchen which still need to be washed. As for me, I teach, before you do the washing up in your home, have a look at how many dishes are clean, how many dishes are dirty, and if the number of clean utensils are in the majority, quit while you're ahead. That's called positive thinking. Instead of being a compulsive cleanliness freak. Some people are like that. So anyway, maybe it's a male thing, I don't know, but sometimes it's... Anyway, you learn how, too.
Do you want another?
Oh. Yeah, okay, go.
Here we go. Not working.
And the switch is wrong.
What have you done with it? What have you done with it?
So. Hold it. So, where was it? Oh, yeah, the nemesis. So, look for the most beautiful part of it. I keep having that positive idea, going into the most beautiful part of it. That is called, in the Anapanasati Sutta, that you learn to brighten the nimitta. It's sampasadana chitta. It also means like bringing confidence and joy to the nimitta. But I like translating that as a more practical way. Brighten, it becomes more bright, more pure. So that's what I've just been talking about. Learn to settle the nimitta, samadhan chitta. To make it still, because that nimitta, sometimes it moves all over the place. Very common when you first see the light in the mind, sometimes the light over here somewhere in the corner. You're looking for it and you chase it away. So you just gotta wait. It's like this little nimitta is checking you out. Are you ready for me yet? I like to sort of, what's it called, anthropomorphize things. Imagine them as beings. They're checking you out, are you still enough yet for me? So you just wait. Never say you can stay in the court if you want. When you're ready, I'm ready for you. And then it will come and center itself in front of you. Sometimes our nimitta is really strong. If they're really, really strong, sometimes you just can't handle them. They're too bright. So bright, you think you're going to go blind. It's not the reason I wear glasses and I've seen too many nimittas. That's not the reason. You don't go blind. You're not seeing these with your physical eyes. You're seeing these with your mind. These are mental objects. So, they can be as bright as they want to be. Brighter than the sun. Brilliant, powerful. Don't be afraid. The reason I tell these things is because it's so common that when people experience nimittas for the first time, they haven't been told what they are or how to deal with them, they think they're going crazy, they think they're going to go mad, beautiful, blind, whatever. They're such fearful beings. You don't go blind. The other thing which happens sometimes is so intense, so much ecstasy and bliss. Sometimes it comes up, came up for me once, only once, that you think no human being can take so much pleasure. You're going to explode and die. The limits of pleasure have been exceeded. Bang! But what I've found is, this is one of the great insights, there's no limit to the amount of pleasure you can feel in the mind. It's all perfectly safe. Are you interested? Of course you are. Because pleasure is very attractive. Especially when this is pleasure, which the Buddha says, will lead you to streaming in once returning, not returning, or full enlightenment. Pretty good deal. So, and then we learn to enter the jhana, liberate the chitta. What happens next is when you start feeling these powerful objects of the mind, when they become still, it's like you enter into them, like you marry them, and they embrace you and go into incredible states of blissful stillness called the jhanas. They are so intense and blissful that one of the signs it must be a jhana was that five senses, they can't affect you at all. You can't hear sound. That has been turned off. You can't see sights. You can't even feel the body. One of my friends has mentioned this in the book Marvelous Bliss and Beyond. He was meditating. He flew to jhana. Sometimes people do that. Really let go. And his wife went to see him in the bedroom because he was in there for too long. And he couldn't see him breathing. So what did she do? She called. In Australia it's 000. Ambulance. It was a Sunday afternoon. The ambulance came as fast as it could. The ambulance men rushed in. They took his pulse. No sign of any pulse. He wasn't breathing. Straight in the ambulance. Rushed to the teaching hospital. It was the Charles Gardner Hospital in Perth. Straight into the emergency room. Put on the ECG, EEG. Both were flat lines. He flatlined. No sign of any heartbeat. No sign of any brain activity. He was dead. Or was he? We've now come to 5 o'clock, so I'll continue. Okay, carry on. I can get a job on the TV, isn't it? Anyway, so, was he dead? Now the doctor on duty that afternoon happened to be he was Australian, but his parents had migrated from India. They were Hindus. And they had told him that some of these people in deep meditation could stop all of their life activities. And he knew that this gentleman had been meditating before. And also the third thing, which was unusual. And this was actually said in the sutras. The third thing was unusual, that his body was warm. It never went cold, like a dead person should be. It was warm. And that's the thing in the Chula Wekul Sutra, the difference between someone who's dead and someone who's deep meditation. They're warm. So if ever you go to the Oxford Vihara, where Chanda lives, and you find he's sitting there perfectly still, don't send her to the crematorium yet. Just check her body temperature. And it's still warm, leave her alone. She's just in jhanas. If you do send her to the crematorium, as I said this morning, you put her in the box, cremate her, and it doesn't work. And imagine just how that would freak out the people in the crematorium. Anyway, so he was warm. So in those days, the wife told me this, because the wife was in attendance, she was really disturbed, that they gave defibrillators to try and get him, his heart going again. These days, I think they inject adrenaline or something. But anyway, defibrillators try and shock his heart into starting again. Apparently, many, many times they did that, and nothing was working. Until, as he told me, he just decided, time to come out of my meditation. He just exited from the meditation and beep, 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 the ECG and the EEG performing normally. And the doctor just gave him a really thorough examination, absolutely nothing wrong with him. So the doctor was taking a bit of a chance, but it's such a weird case that he should have really kept him in overnight. But so now, can't see anything wrong with you. so sent him home. So he literally walked home with his wife. And he said that was the worst part of the whole experience. Everything else was so much pleasure and bliss, but the scolding he got from his wife on the way home. Don't you ever do that again. I was so scared, he said. But that has lots of interesting parts to that real story. One was that even having electric shocks on him, you just can't feel them. You can't hear the sound of this silence. You can't feel anything. But you're perfectly aware. You're not unconscious. All that consciousness is in that sixth sense of mind. And it's temporarily dislocated from the five senses. But you can't be hurt at all. Isn't that cool? Or is that scary? For some people it's scary. But if you get close to those states, the joy, the happiness is so strong. It's as if you're on the edge. You know, just one more step, you're in jhana. Stay here, you've got some sort of control over anything. But then, the joy is just too strong. The pleasure, the bliss, the profundity just draws you in. This path was not joyful. I don't think anyone would have the courage to get into jhana, to let go so much. You're sacrificing so much, really renouncing letting go. But you do it because it's enormous joy and happiness, and it gives you incredible insights. You're like the tadpole has become a frog. You're jumping out, you're seeing the world, existence, the nature in a totally different way. That is where the insights come from, and that will be part of episode 3 tomorrow, the jhanas and beyond.
Okay, so hopefully you enjoy these suttas and give them with a little bit of oomph to make them interesting and to remember them. And please don't ever be scared of this. They're totally safe. The only thing which might happen if you do these jhanas too much, some people lose their hair. I think you know what I mean, don't you? Okay. Sadhu.
Sadhu. Sadhu.
Okay, have you tried that? Very good. So now what we're doing now, we've got 25 minutes more meditation.
Oh, no, 6:30.
Oh, another hour of meditation.